In August, the Frederick County Council voted by a slim 4-3 margin to repeal an English-only ordinance that had been passed in 2012. In reading the many impassioned letters to the editor about this issue, one missing component from almost all the English-only supporters was an acknowledgement of the history of this land called Frederick prior to the founding of the United States, which was only less than 250 years ago. Many of the arguments seem grounded in a worldview that English is clearly the first, the only, the best language for this land, and that it should be the unquestioned norm for the future. That perspective reminds me of a political cartoon in which a white man in an expensive suit, we'll call him Donald Trump, is yelling at a Latino family, "It's time to reclaim America from the illegal immigrants." Now, off to the side of the cartoon is an American Indian standing stern with his arms crossed, and he simply responds, "Oh, I'll help you pack." And regarding some of the false mythologies around our country's history, one of the most common sins of omission is starting the story far too late, with the first major highlight being the arrival of Columbus in the Americas. But this Eurocentric version of history omits literally millennia of history on this continent. As Dr. Roseanne Dunbar-Ortiz details in her important book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, published by the UUA's own Beacon Press, she says that it may be true that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. But 10,000 years earlier, in approximately 8500 BCE, semi-nomadic groups of hunter-gatherers began to practice agriculture in seven different places around the globe. Three of the seven were here in the Americas. All were based around corn. The Valley of Mexico and Central America, the South Central Andes in South America, and Eastern North America. The other early agricultural centers were the Tigris and Euphrates and Nile River systems, sub-Saharan Africa, the Yellow River of northern China, and the Yangtze River of southern China. Over the next 10,000 years, indigenous people on this continent produced complex irrigation systems put in place at least 2,000 years before Europeans knew that the Americas existed. There were explorers that marveled that, take the Iroquois villages, for example, that there were 6 miles of cornfields surrounding each of their villages through those complex irrigation systems. In the 10th century, 500 years before Columbus, the Mayans built breathtaking city-states with structures that continue to astonish to this day, like Chichen Itza, Mayapan, and Uxmal, and other such sites. Mayan culture is often compared to Greek Athenian culture. The Mayan people developed art, architecture, sculpture, painting. Surrounded by rubber trees, they invented the rubber ball and court ball games similar to modern soccer. By 36 BCE, well before a few decades before Jesus, around the time of the Roman Empire was getting started, the Mayans developed the concept of zero, and they worked with numbers into the hundreds of millions. Modern astronomers have marveled at the accuracy of Mayan charts of the movements of the moon and planets, which were used to predict eclipses and other events with a high degree of accuracy. Also, centuries before Columbus, the Anasazi, who lived in the Chaco Canyon, the present-day Four Corners region of the U.S., where Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah meet, they constructed more than 400 miles of roads that radiated out from Chaco. These roads averaged being 30 feet wide, and they followed straight courses even through difficult terrain with hill and rock formations. These highways connected some 75 different communities. Many indigenous people groups also had the regular practice of burning the undergrowth in surrounding forests and to cultivate the land. So there are real senses in which the land of the Americas was more of a wilderness a few centuries after Columbus arrived than before he arrived, because the practice of burning the undergrowth was stopped as the indigenous people were driven into hiding and out of the places where they had been. So this European myth, though, tells of discovering a new world, of discovering a virgin wilderness that just happened to be lovingly cropped with the undergrowth removed. From this perspective, the Europeans viewed themselves as bringing the gifts of civilization and the one true religion of Christianity. So they viewed themselves as saving these indigenous people both in this world and the next. You know, these primitive heathens, as they were viewed as being. But centuries before the colonial period of the United States, the indigenous peoples of this land had advanced agriculture, sophisticated education and culture, and extensive transportation networks. Tomorrow, Monday, October 12th, is known as Columbus Day. It commemorates the anniversary of Columbus landing in the Americas on October 12th, 1492. But it turns out that even though our nation's capital, the District of Columbia, or Columbia University, we can name other examples, are named after him, Columbus didn't discover America. If anything, he covered over the history of the Americas before his arrival. At least he didn't discover America in the sense that he never set foot in North America, much less the land we now call the United States. Columbus's first voyage landed him in what is known as today as the Dominican Republic and Haiti. And he did not come to bring life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to the indigenous populations. Rather, he returned home with enslaved members of the indigenous population and stolen gold. When he returned on his second voyage, what he discovered was that his colony of 40 Europeans that he'd left behind had all been slaughtered by the indigenous population, who it turns out didn't like being enslaved and having their gold stolen. So disregarding the resistance of the indigenous people, Columbus enslaved another 400 natives to take back with his second voyage to Spain. On his third trip, he landed in what is now Venezuela, and on his fourth and final trip, he reached the Caribbean coast of Central America. And although there were other explorers of note as well, Balboa, Ponce de Leon, Magellan, and others, Columbus is the most famous, but he's also increasingly infamous as increasing attention is brought to the rest of the story from the perspective of the indigenous people. From an indigenous perspective, we can hear that even beloved populist tunes like from the UU, you know, Woody Guthrie, who is a Unitarian or was a Unitarian Universalist until his death recently, that there's this unconscious bias often toward the manifest destiny for Europeans. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. But then what about the people who had already been on this land for 10,000 years? From the European perspective, the answer to that question was to reinforce the Columbus myth with the legal doctrine of discovery. The doctrine of discovery took the medieval worldview that had justified the Crusades and applied it to the colonization of the Americas. In the Middle Ages, papal bulls had been written encouraging Christians to, quote, capture, vanquish, and subdue the pagans and other enemies of Christ, to put them into perpetual slavery, and to take all their possessions and property. That was the sort of coming down, this is what Jesus wants you to do and how you should do the Crusades. And so what happened was, if you go back and read pre-colonial sermons, then you see time after time different ministers saying, you, European explorers, are the new Israelites. This land is the new Canaan. You need to do to them what the Israelites did to the Canaanites. You know, take the land by any means necessary. It is rightfully yours. This is now the new Israel. So that same doctrine of discovery, as initially articulated by Roman Catholic Pope Nicholas V in 1452, by various kings of England, that was directly imported into our United States legal system and remains there today. When they were coming up with, you know, how do we legally justify taking of the lands? They just looked to that doctrine of discovery in the Crusades and put it right into our laws. For example, in 1823, the Supreme Court case Johnson versus McIntosh, writing for a unanimous court, Chief Justice John Marshall observed that Christian nations had assumed ultimate dominion over the lands of America during the Age of Discovery, and that upon discovery, the Indians had lost their rights to complete sovereignty as independent nations and only retained a right of occupancy. As recently as 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court explicitly referenced the doctrine of discovery in the city of Sherrill versus the Oneida Indian Nation of New York. Quote, under the doctrine of discovery, fee title to the lands occupied by Indians when colonists arrived became vested in the sovereign. First, the discovering European nation, and later, the original states and the United States. There is no sense of irony in that court opinion that the sovereignty of the indigenous people and their nations is being ignored. And the myth is perpetuated that these indigenous people were just primitive heathens that were merely occupying the land in a way that was not civilized and didn't have to be respected. The U.S. Constitution does have one explicit reference to the indigenous populations of North America in Article 1, Section 8. It says that Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among several states and with the Indian tribes. But as we have seen, the indigenous people of this land were much more than tribes of hunter-gatherers. They were sophisticated nations with complex cultures and established governments, and had been for millennia. And although the U.S. Constitution also says in Article 6 that all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound hereby, there is a long history of the U.S. government breaking treaties with indigenous nations in a series of land grabs. But over the years, indigenous activists and allies have continued to demand justice. And although the Middle Passage and the racist enslavement of Africans is sometimes referred to as the original sin of this country, and it is one of them, the earlier crime was the displacement, enslavement, and slaughter of the indigenous people of this land. In the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., our nation was born in genocide. We tried as a matter of national policy to wipe out the indigenous population. Moreover, we elevated that tragic experience into a noble crusade. Indeed, even today, we have not permitted ourselves to reject or feel remorse for this shameful episode. And in some of what Charles shared, you can hear that the reason Dr. King was moved by the plight of the American Indian, the clear parallels there in the prejudice. And that word genocide is a strong one, but it is also an accurate one. Nearly all the population areas of the Americas were reduced by 90% following the onset of the colonizing projects, decreasing the targeted indigenous populations of the Americas from 100 million to 10 million. That's the whole of the Americas. If you look just at the current area of the United States, the population is nearly 3 million indigenous people living on indigenous land now, down from around 15 million original inhabitants. And of the approximate 1,904 million acres in the continental U.S., so rounding about 2,000 million acres in the U.S., in 1881, Indian land holdings in the United States had gone down from 2,000 for the whole land to 156 million acres in 1881. By 1934, through, you know, treaties being compromised and land grabs, it had gone down to about 50 million acres remaining, about the size of Idaho and Washington put together. During World War II, the U.S. government took another 500,000 more acres for military use. By 1955, the indigenous land base had shrunk to just 2.3% of the original size. Accordingly, what most indigenous activists call for is not monetary reparations. So that's what you hear sometimes racial justice advocates asking for. But instead, they ask for restoration, restitution, and repatriation of land stolen by the United States outside of valid treaties. One of the most prominent and painful examples is Mount Rushmore, which was carved into the Lakota Sioux's sacred site, the Pahasapa, or Black Hills. From the perspective of standard U.S. history, these 60-foot visages of four of our U.S. presidents, Washington, Jefferson, Roosevelt, and Lincoln, are a shrine to democracy. At least from the Native American perspective, it wasn't Jackson up there, who is usually seen as the worst offender, but it's still, from an indigenous perspective, a desolating sacrilege, a shrine of in-your-face illegal occupation and colonialism. Indeed, in 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against the United States government awarding the Sioux Nation $106 million for that stolen land on which Mount Rushmore is called. But from the perspective of the Sioux, the land was never for sale. That money remains untouched in an interest-bearing account, is today worth more than $1.3 billion. That is left untouched because it was seen as that would be a sacrilege to touch it. They don't see it as their money to spend. What they want is their sacred land back. There have been other moves toward justice. In 1970, President Richard Nixon signed into a law that was the first land restitution to any indigenous nation, returning 48,000 acres that had been taken from the Taos Pueblo Indians. Most recently, in late August, President Obama restored the name of the tallest mountain in North America, which had become known as Mount McKinley, to its original indigenous name, Denali. October 12, 1992 was the quincentennial, the 500th anniversary of Columbus landing on the shores of the Americas. To celebrate this occasion at the United Nations, both Spain and the Vatican, who had a lot to do with that original doctrine of discovery and was sending Columbus here, said that we should have an emphasis on this occasion of the Europeans bearing the gifts of civilization and Christianity to the indigenous people. This is 1992. Both the United States and Canada voted to support that resolution. And then they were shocked when the entire African delegation promptly stood up and walked out of the room, returning only with a statement explaining why this was an incredibly offensive and colonialist proposal. Over time, increasing numbers of groups have begun to celebrate October 12th each year, not as Columbus Day, but as Indigenous Peoples Day, an occasion at least annually to remember an American Indian Indigenous people's perspective on the United States history. In the spirit, when thinking about what music or hymn we could conclude and move to after the sermon on the eve of Indigenous Peoples Day, a confession seemed appropriate, and perhaps the most moving confession in our hymnal, and you can turn to it, is 1037. But as you turn to the hymn, you'll see that the refrain will be invited to sing, and Karen's going to help lead us through that. So it's the same, I'll read a line, and then there'll be music, and the music's slightly different every time, so Karen's going to help us with that with one of the handheld mics. It's, we forgive ourselves and each other, we begin again in love. But unless we're descendants of indigenous people of this land, forgiveness is not ours to offer. But if we are to move forward toward justice, we must be willing to allow our hearts to break open in compassion, to break open in sorrow, and to begin again in love, to find a new way. So as we prepare to sing, I'll close with these words from Willie Johns of the Brighton Seminole Reservation in Florida. He writes, "We are here mostly and foremost to educate and not to forgive. We are here also to educate, to enlighten, and not to accuse." So feeling the tension of those words with the lyrics of this hymn, and as you wrestle inside yourself with what we are and aren't able to forgive in various areas of our life, both individual and systemic, I invite you to rise as we prepare to sing together and to try to move into the future with love. For remaining silent when a single voice would have made a difference.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For each time that our fears have made us rigid and inaccessible.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For each time we have struck out in anger without just cause.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For each time that our greed has blinded us to the needs of others.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For the selfishness that sets us apart and alone.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For falling short of the admonitions of the Spirit.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For losing sight of our unity.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again in love.
For those and for so many acts, both evident and subtle, which have fueled the illusion of separateness.
We forgive ourselves and each other. We begin again.